Hi, I'm Deborah Shapiro, and welcome to Cooks and Books, a show where we'll talk about stories and have conversations with folks who are passionate about food, who put it on our tables, and who put it into words. And I have two wonderful guests for my inaugural show today, Chef Mark Timms. He's an award-winning chef, and he's at the Top Notch Resort in Stowe, Vermont. And Diane Imrie, who's a wonderfully talented home cook who's written a wonderful cookbook called Cooking Close to Home. And you'll find that these folks have a lot more in common than you might think from just hearing that brief introduction. And what I hope to do with you guys each twice a month, actually, is talk about cooks, talk about books, really bring you the stories and personalities of folks who inspire us and inspire the kind of food we want to eat. So I need to start by thanking Hearst Ranch and Fairway Market, who is like no other market. They're sponsors for the Heritage Radio Network. And we're excited to get to our first show. That song you just heard was a Nora Jones song. And what I thought would be fun is for the soundtrack to reflect our guests and what they might be listening to in the kitchen or when they're writing, because we all know that music can be a big part of creativity. And you'll get a sense of how different they might be alike in a lot of their personalities and in their values and their passions, these guests today, but they're a little different in their musical taste. So hopefully we'll get to share that with you as well. So why don't we take a quick break and come back with a song that represents Chef Mark Timms before we get started, and I'll look forward to being with you in just a minute. Bye-bye. I can feel the soul falling over my head. And as I climb into an empty bed, oh well, enough said. I know it's over, still I cling. I don't know where else I can go. Oh, mother, I can feel. Welcome back, and something really fun just happened in the studio. That song was by the Smiths, and Chef Timms told me that was one of his favorite bands, and Diane jumped in and said, oh, the Smiths, I love the Smiths. So I may find out that these guys have even more in common than I thought. So let me welcome Chef Mark Timms, and you may have heard about him. He was a top chef in Atlanta. He's currently at the Top Notch Resort and Spa. He's going to be leading what he calls Team Vermont to the James Beard House on March 22nd in New York. And I'm going to let him tell you a little bit about himself and how he got into food, what made him interested and what brought him to food in the first place. Welcome.
Thank you very much. How I got into food was a child growing up in the UK in foster homes. And if you've spent time in England, you would know the food is not so great in the UK, especially in foster homes. Always a very artistic child growing up, always drawing pictures. I always loved modeling with clay. And one of the foster families who actually adopted me in later years said, instead of going to art school as you get older, why don't you try culinary school, cooking school? And I said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. So as the years went on, I grew a passion for cooking, and I used it as a means to expand and grow and spend some time in London. And from London, I moved to the U.S. After culinary school and never looked back. So that's how I fell into it. I wanted to be an art student, then became a cooking student, and then moved to the U.S. in 1990.
And that would explain anyone who's seen your food. That really explains, because it's so artistic, that really gives me an insight into where that inspiration comes from.
That's right.
Everything really looks so beautiful on
the
plate.
Thank you.
And Diane, tell us, Diane is the director of nutrition, and patient services, or nutrition, and just director of nutrition, at Fletcher Allen Healthcare. But we have her here today as our guest. You may remember her when we talked about Healthcare Without Harm and the hospital that she is in charge of a few weeks back. But today we're talking to her about Cooking Close to Home, and it's a wonderful book. It's available on Amazon and in bookstores around the country and at her website, cookingclosetohome.com. But tell us how you got into food and what would lead you to write a book.
Well, writing a book was certainly on my life list for, it's been on my life list for many years. I didn't know at the time that I wrote it that it was going to be a cookbook. So, but how I got into cooking, I think I've just always had an interest in food as it relates to family. And I started cooking very young. My mom was ill when I was very young, and so independently started cooking and just got an interest in it. And then that translated into an interest in nutrition. So I went to McGill for dietetics and really have always been more interested in the food side versus the clinical nutrition side. And then 3-4 years back, at a party at my house, we had all kinds of great food that friends had brought, and someone said, oh, you should write a cookbook with my co-author. And we decided a couple of weeks later, maybe that wasn't such a crazy idea, and we got started.
And what's interesting about your book is you've self-published it, so you carried it all the way through.
Yes, so we've done, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about it, but we've done bits of everything that's required to get a book onto the shelf, so we learned a lot.
Good for you.
Mm-hmm. That's very exciting. Well, why Vermont? We're actually, I'm talking to two folks who are both in Vermont.
Right.
And Chef Timms, you came from Atlanta and obviously the UK to the U.S.
Right.
So I wondered a little bit about what brought you to Vermont.
My wife is from Vermont. And number two, I think Vermont is a great place to raise children and is a great place to be part of a community, to grow a community and to put my arms around things, projects like the Vermont Campaign and other things that I love. I think it's such a great family atmosphere here, and I like that for the kids.
Well, and beyond your cooking, that's something we should share with people. We mentioned the whole Team Vermont idea, and we'll tell folks a little bit more about what that is in a minute. But you have done a lot of community-oriented activities
right.
and brought together a lot of community groups. Do you think that would be as easy to do in other climates, or do you think there's something about Vermont that makes it easier?
Vermont is great because in Vermont, somebody knows somebody who can help you. For example, I'm putting together a project for the Food and Wine Show August 21st of this year, and talking to other chefs who know other chefs or know celebrity chefs, the event has grown bigger and bigger as the weeks go on. So in Vermont, people are willing to help, and I think people are great here. I think it's a good family, good values. It's easier here than it was in Atlanta, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think so.
To get that across. And, Diane, you've brought some amazing initiatives also into your world with CSAs and different things that you've brought together to create community around your workplace.
Absolutely, at the hospital.
Yeah.
We've really encouraged a very strong food community and a sense of culture around the food at the hospital, which I think is unique, particularly given that it's a hospital. It's not what people expect.
Mm-hmm. And so the fact that people do know each other the way they do, you have to be careful what you say, right?
Right. You do.
You have to like everybody.
The chances are actually good that the other person knows.
Exactly.
Whoever you're talking about. Yeah. You have to be particularly careful. Well, let's go into the kitchen a little bit.
Okay.
So let's pretend you just went to the farmer's market on Saturday.
Right.
And this time of year, living where we're living in a New England climate, we would be finding root vegetables and What do you think would inspire you, and what might you put together? How do you go about putting something together?
For me personally, it's talking to the farmers on a weekly basis, what's growing, what's cool, what's hot is what we talk about. For example, root vegetables, and then taking those items and creating a great dish and just going through cookbooks, looking for ideas and inspiration with those local farmers, and just creating a great dish that you think that your guests haven't seen before in this area. I'm always looking for cutting edge, always new things, always exciting things, and taking Vermont products and putting them onto almost a canvas, a white plate canvas, and changing it into an art form is what I look for in every dish. And I get inspiration from cookbooks or from the internet or from paintings, and that's why I take those products and change them around.
And you had, at the Team Vermont dinner, you're going to be serving your virtual egg.
Right.
And you could tell us a little. So I had the pleasure of going to one of the sort of, what would we call it, a dress rehearsal for
yes,
the
a
Team Vermont dinner. And so they, Chef Timms' dish is a wonderful deconstructed beef Wellington.
Right.
And he garnished it, I guess we could say, right? This is garnished
it,
with the
right.
egg. So it looked exactly like a hard-boiled egg, but it was?
It wasn't. It was mozzarella cheese that was grated with Parmesan cheese, added to warm milk, and then sheets of gelatin pureed. and you pour that into a mold, and you do the same kind of principle with yellow tomato. You puree that with aspic, and then you freeze the little balls of yellow tomato aspic and apply that to your little mozzarella mold, and then you have this beautiful virtual egg. And I thought it was a cool, unique way to present this dish, and I really liked it. So.
And where did you get the inspiration to be involved in molecular? We call that molecular gastronomy, right? Would you say? Is it part of the artistic interest that you have?
It is. I think all chefs are artists. I think, I mean, I appreciate Monet to Van Gogh to Turner to a lot of artists. And I think that for me, I'm a very complex and unusual person in the way that I like all things, but I like things to be different, cutting edge, and fun. And molecular is that outlet for me to create and be cutting edge and to have fun with food and take it to a different level, a different art form. And molecular allows me to do that in a different way. And when you have a meal with me, I want you to say, wow, what made this guy think of that? He's one of my sayings from the past, and that's the way I look at food.
So when we sit there and we say, what made you think of that? That's sort of one of your goals?
That is
what
my
you
goals.
Want to have
I
happen
want,
when
I
your
want
plate
you to
comes out.
Shocked and surprised and happy, all those emotions to come through. Not just a plate of food.
So be entertained.
Entertained, and you should be entertained if you're going to eat. You spend a lot of money, and it's an escape from reality. You're there for 45 minutes, an hour and a half. You should be entertained because you're spending a lot of money to eat in my restaurant. So.
I think that's a wonderfully thoughtful attitude. And we have a guest in our studio who I haven't mentioned. Gabrielle is the chef's daughter. She won't be speaking with us on the air today, but I want to mention her because I know she's a big inspiration for Chef,
and
a lot of why he's so interested in all the things he wants to do for children in the community and the type of things that you're focusing on.
Right.
And I wanted to ask you, though, so now if you're at home,
right,
are you making virtual eggs at home?
No, it's, let me get a little tell you, it's pizza, it's chicken fingers, it's macaroni and cheese. It's
but all homemade?
Most of the time it's homemade. I try to make it homemade. I want it to be homemade, but kids can be a little awkward at 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. So, I mean, Gabby, I'll tell you, she corn and chicken, so simple things. Right, Gabby?
One day you'll appreciate a little more of some of the fancier items that are on the plate. And, Diane, what sort of would have inspired you? Because your book, Diane's book, really is written with an inclination toward a CSA or a farmer's market, do you mind if I borrow this? And so she really takes you through the seasons. What are some of the things you've been making recently?
Well, actually, it's interesting, as Mark was answering his question, I was thinking, I come at this in a completely different way, much more functional. What's available is what I'll make. And you do that as well at the farmer's market. So I think about right now, I've been picking up my CSA down at the Innerville Community Farm every 2 weeks. And let's see, the last pickup I had roasted root vegetables last night, which were fabulous. Chicken with a honey sauce, which I got some honey in my last share. Apple butter came in my last share as a nice surprise.
Nice.
Maple yogurt. So it's much more around whatever kind of is a surprise in the share is what I've been cooking with. But I think that cooking with the seasons is much more, and the idea of the book is more homestyle, I think. Definitely not a restaurant-focused kind of cookbook, but more functional. Whatever you might find at the farmer's market is what you're able to cook today.
Good.
And both of you have an interest in nutrition and what's healthy for people. Mm-hmm. And how much of eating seasonally is a contributor to that?
Oh, I think it's a great contributor, because whatever's in season is usually the freshest, and fresher food is more nutritious. And it's usually closer to home, because if it's in season and you're able to get it close to home, it means you probably might know something about the farm where it's raised. You can ask all kinds of questions at the farmer's market around nutrition. Did they use antibiotics to raise the meat? So I think it's a great opportunity to improve nutrition, actually.
Well, and on the scale of a home cook, that makes a lot of sense. How does that translate to the scale of a restaurant? So when you've got people coming from all over who...
It's important with us. We have a spa, and all of our guests that go to the spa, they want the spa cuisine, as we used to call it at the Lodge at Woodlock, food that is, if you're having a treatment, giving a massage, it's important to put the right food into your body after your massage or after the treatment you've had. For us, we develop a menu quarterly that blends with the seasons, and I look for superfoods into the menu. So each menu item must have at least one superfood element to the dish, and the protein has to be lean. And those are the things I look at, all natural, all great local ingredients is what I use for the spa menu. And I find myself, you know, going through stages where I'll eat that for 5, 6, 7 weeks, and then I'll go off the wagon, I'll eat poorly again, and then I go into the healthier stage again. So I would like to get myself to a point where, I mean, that's all I'm eating the whole time.
It's all about balance.
And what are the superfoods, since we have you here with us?
Oh, lots of the foods that I think about. I mean, superfoods is a sort of a term that can be confusing, but you think about lots of foods with high in antioxidants, like blueberries, cranberries, things with omega-3 fatty acids, like walnuts and...
Which we don't grow walnuts in Vermont, and we don't have fish in Vermont, and we don't have blueberries this time of year. Yep. So what do you recommend people do?
I'm still eating blueberries from the freezer, and I dried some cherries last year, so I'm still eating my own dried cherries that are high in antioxidants. Certainly fish, depending on where you live, I just say try and get it as local as you can. I certainly keep to North America. So I don't eat any of the imported fishes necessarily, but try and keep it as close as you can to home. There's a great guide, if you've never seen this, on Monterey Bay Aquarium website. Just got renewed and updated, and it talks about what are the best fish, the next best choices, and then fish to avoid for health.
Great. Well, and it is a little different in a restaurant, though, because you've got a demanding public who may not have the same... standard that you, but I think it's changing more and more to where consumers are starting to ask about where is that from.
They absolutely do. I have to put on my first menu page a description of where my beef comes from, why I buy the beef from there, because it's naturally raised. And guests are very up to date with where the food trends and what's going on. I think they know, they're savvy. The diner is more savvy today than they were 10 years ago, for sure. And so I find myself always trying to find the new farm to work with. It was all natural, and advertising that, and then the new cheesemaker. They want to know who these people are. And it's almost like you have to write a book as a menu so that people know what's going on with their choices of the day. So.
Well, why don't we take a short break, and then when we come back, I'm going to ask both of our guests about what goes on in the kitchen, some tips and tricks and some of the things we may not really know about that they might be able to teach us. Thanks.
Dollars, there is but one concern I have just discovered. Some girls are bigger than others. Some girls are bigger than others. Some girls' mothers are bigger than other girls' mothers. Some girls are bigger than others. Some girls are bigger than others. Some girls' mothers are bigger than other girls' mothers. As Antony said to Cleopatra, as he opened the crater veil, oh, I said, some girls are bigger than others. Some girls.
Hi, welcome back to Cooks and Books on the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks so much to our sponsor, Fairway Market, like no other market. It's the place that you want to shop. And I'm here with my guest, Chef Mark Timms. He is the executive chef at the Top Notch Resort in Stowe, Vermont. And Diane Imrie, who's the author, one of the co-authors. Her co-author is Richard Jarmus. She and Richard Jarmus have written Cooking Close to Home. And we've talked a little bit in the first half about what brought them to food and a little bit about superfoods, but now I want to ask them a little bit about what I might find if I came into their kitchen and what it would be like to be in there, their cooking style, and sort of what goes on to getting to the place where you're confident enough to cook and could do all this for other people as well as write a book. So why don't we start with Diane this time and tell us a little bit about what made you think that your recipes were good enough
to put in the book. That's a big, challenging question, I have to say, especially the way you phrased it. How we did it was Richard and I would, our ground rules were around recipes were what's available at a certain time of year. So we were pretty limited in the amount of time we had to work with products that were available, say, in the summer. And so we would take a recipe and say we'd really like to have these 3-4 ingredients in it, and then just play with those a little bit. We used more of the exotics as well, so we didn't limit ourselves to not using olive oil or vanilla, just because you can't, you really need those for good flavors. And then Richard and I would separately be toying with recipes at home, and our spouses were treated to lots and lots and lots of cooking at home. And then when either of us felt it was good enough to sample, we would have a sample evening. And so we would both bring 2-3 dishes together and cook them for each other and for our spouses, and we would give critique. And sometimes we would cook them for other people so that we could get some feedback about that. And if all went well, it went in the book. There were a couple that didn't go so well, and they aren't in the book.
Well, and so the techniques that you learned, you just learned them as a home cook over time? Did you?
I mean, I had some very limited, knife handling skills in school, but it wasn't like going to cooking school. I wish I had gone to cooking school, but I didn't.
And what would be different if you'd gone to cooking school, do you think?
I think I would feel much more confident cooking. I like the flavors that I like, and I've learned to like them over the years by going out to restaurants and cooking with other people. But I think I still feel less confident, certainly, than my co-author, who is a trained executive chef. So I counted on him sometimes to be able to describe things that I didn't maybe have the words for because I didn't have the training. But I could tell him exactly what I wanted it to taste like, and he would say, let's add a little of this. And he would usually hit it right nail on the head.
And so, chef, since we have a chef here who did go to culinary school, what about what Diane's talking about? Where does that come in the culinary training? Is there a specific aspect of culinary training that's all about that taste component? Or
I think over time it becomes second nature. I think that in the kitchen, we do the same thing you do. We do tastings with our menu choices. We have the waitstaff sit down, and we go through a line of the new options for the whatever season it is, and some make it, some don't. So, what you did was a great call to do that. But we know what we like as chefs, and sometimes it is the tricky part. We like a dish, and we appreciate it, but sometimes it doesn't relate to our guests because they may not understand where we're coming from. So we have to tone things down as well. So there's a lot of trial and error in our kitchen as to we'll bring people in and do 8 dishes at one time and have all the entire wait staff and the executive committee come in and sit down and critique our menu choices for us. But we have to almost, not the AG's word dumb it down, but tone it down for some of our guests.
So can you give me an example of a dish that went through that? I'd be curious. Like something that as you conceived it.
Right.
Okay, give me one.
One was a deconstructed fish and chips.
Okay.
So if you read on the menu fish and chips, you expect it to be the battered fish and chips with the battered fish and the french fries and tartar sauce. My version of it would be a pan-seared piece of halibut with maybe a malt vinegar aioli with potato gaufrettes, where you take the potato and slice it on a mandolin to get these nice waffle shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And then a pea puree, because in England we do mushy peas and we do a pea puree. So that was my version of it. That didn't relate well with certain people on the panel that taste the food, and so it has to go back to a basic fish and chip. So certain things have to be tweaked back.
So something very iconic.
Right.
Something that has so much, and knowing that you're British, people probably coming in and saying, wanting to taste your fish and chips.
And then it's this version of what I think a cool fish and chip should look like, and so that's what goes on. We do a lot of things like that going on in the kitchen all the time.
Now, where's one that you were surprised? Where's one that you thought, oh, this might be way over, but in the end they surprised you and they really loved it? Can you think of one?
I can think of one, yes. One was maple syrup caviar, which is actually, again, the molecular culinary. You take molecular syrup, add the metal to it, one of the chemicals to it, put it into a calcic bath and make these little caviar pellets. And that worked out pretty well. I mean, it was just this little amuse bouche. But people loved that as an idea, the twist. And I thought, sitting down, I thought, I'm really taking a risk here with this dish because I don't think they're going to understand it, but I think people really appreciated the effort and the thought that went into this product, this Vermont product being maple syrup, and tweaking it and making it into caviar, turning it into caviar. So that was one interesting dish that worked out quite well when I was cringing as it was going out. We should have done this. So.
And it worked out in the end.
It worked out in the end.
Which is great.
Yeah, it was good.
And Diane, what makes you cringe? Have you had any cringes?
I did. There was one recipe. I was insistent that we were going to use cabbage in a soup. I wanted to do a nice cabbage soup. And I had in my mind some German flavors. And so I wanted to use some local sausage, Vermont smoking cure sausage, and some cabbage and caraway. And I had those flavors in my mind, and I could not make that soup work. And after the third time, my husband said, you know, I think we should just throw out the recipe and let it go. And then vice versa, though, I had a soup, a hot and sour dandelion in spinach soup. And first time, nailed it. I made a teeny tiny adjustment in the recipe, and I loved it. And everyone gave us good feedback. So it really depends. Sometimes you have something in your mind, and you're really able to translate it to the plate. Sometimes not.
Any suggestions on that?
Well, the dish I did for you on February the 1st,
beef Wellington,
that's going to be tweaked again. And I need to see a dish visually. I like to sketch it out first, see it visually, have people taste it, and I can go back and change it again. I think that's a prime example of a dish that will stay, but it needs to be tweaked.
And are you comfortable sharing how you might tweak? Maybe we could tell our listeners. So we're going to create this lovely taste experience for you over the radio. Mm. So the plate comes out of the kitchen, and you smell the aroma of...
You smell the aroma. Oh, actually, the dish consists of oxtail, that's pan-seared, fresh tongue, cow's tongue, that's pickled, and then and braised, and then duck liver pate. And it's layered with these crisp potatoes and cubed demi-glaze on top with the virtual egg. But here's where I thought the dish missed. It needed more of a sauce to bring out the life of the actual Napoleon version of the dish. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking as the dish went out, it needed more of like a parsley coulis to come off the plate. And then the dish, then the Napoleon, and then the final touches to the dish to make it more visually appealing, because I thought it lacked the visual love that I like to give a dish.
Well, having had the dish, it did taste delicious.
Good.
I do think that parsley would be lovely, so I'll look forward to having that in New York. What about cooking with Diane? You talked about, you know, really caring about the people around the table. Mm-hmm. You both care about the people around the table,
right,
but in somewhat different ways. If I were in the kitchen cooking with you, let's start with Diane, because I know there's some folks who really don't want people cooking with. They just want them eating with. What's that like?
Oh, I love to cook with other people. So I have friends that, you know, we might call each other and say, what's in your fridge? What's in my fridge? Bring it over, and we'll cook it together. And I love to do that. And then I have other friends who I do some preserves with once a year. And that's, you know, we might not see each other often during the year, but we'll make strawberry jam in late June together. And so I think that working in the kitchen is so much more enjoyable with two people, someone to chat with, enjoy the food together afterwards. My husband doesn't cook with me a lot, but he always kind of hovers close by, which I love, because we might have a glass of wine together and I'll chat, get caught up about the day, but it doesn't mean I need to have some chopping for me, although he will tell you, if he walks by, he will be assigned something.
So it's sort of, for you, it's a gathering, but now in a professional kitchen, I did read, Chef, that you talked about yourself sort of evolving from more of the, you know, you evolved to having a little bit of a different attitude in the kitchen. Instead of it being, we all know that famous chefs have egos, right? That's part of the job. and right. that you seem to have gotten beyond that and gone to the next level.
My goal is to bring all these chefs together, like the team of them on. In the kitchen myself, I do like to create a dish by myself and be left alone because it's personal. However, in the outside world, and what I want to develop in Vermont is a team of chefs where put egos to one side and let's do what's best for the community and what's best for Vermont. And it seems to be working because right now with Team Vermont, you've got two guys, Eric from End of the World, who's nominated now for the James Beard, and also Stephen Laura, Al's French Fries. And so giving my attention to other people and wishing people the best can only reflect on me as a human being as I grow, as my soul grows in this life, in this world, I'm getting good results from it. And it used to be about me when I was in Charleston. I spent some years in Charleston with a restaurant down there. And I think you become isolated. I think you become selfish. And that's not the person I want to be. As a chef, I want to see other chefs develop and do well. And Vermont is such a great place for all these great chefs. I think the spotlight needs to be shown a little bit more in Vermont. And it's happening. It's working.
Mm-hmm.
I think Team Vermont's done a good job with that. And it can only grow from here. And our goal is to make sure we have no hungry kids in Vermont at all.
Which is a great goal. And I want to get back to that. But if you don't mind my asking, what happened for you that made you say after you left Charleston, you know, was it, if it's not too personal?
No. Children. I mean, definitely when Gabby was born and Fionn, my son, and Eris, my youngest, you change, you grow. It just happened overnight. You grow. I was humbled. Let's say I was humbled, too, in life. Life has been somewhat humbling. And I'm just now becoming very successful as a chef. And it's because my view has changed, and I've changed as a person. And I see good things coming from it. And, I mean, Team Vermont's a big example of that. And the March 21st event, it's just blowing up.
Well, March 22nd, got to get our date right.
No, that was last year.
Oh, last year. Right,
March,
yeah, tell us about that, because you were there last year in the spring.
Developed a program called the Rising Star Chefs. And I wanted to bring in all the chefs that I knew that were rising stars in their area, Charleston, Atlanta, Boston, and Vermont, and organize a food and wine show that I want to match, eventually, Aspen and the wine Charleston.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's my goal. It's a big goal. It'll take a few years to do that. So we started off with all these chefs. I had 16 chefs last year. I had local vendors, local cheesemakers. We had Harvey Keitel show up for the show. It was fantastic.
Fantastic.
And people said, Mark, this was the best shows we've ever been to in Vermont. And it was for the Vermont campaign to end childhood hunger, which I wish they would reduce the name to something shorter. But it would be a lot easier, but I think they are. To raise money for children, again, the response was so great that this year it's already started to grow and people want to do it again. And so we've locked in the date, March 21st. I've got Ken Oranger from...
you mean August 21st?
August 21st,
August
sorry.
I
apologize.
That's okay.
We've got Ken Oranger from Clio, Andy Husbands from Hell's Kitchen, and he has a restaurant called Tremont 647. I'm trying to get my hands on David Burke from Park Avenue Cafe. I've got a guy from PBS show in Charleston called Bob Wagner coming up. So a lot of top celebrity chefs coming up for this, plus Team Vermont, and plus... I'm trying to get my hands on Ming Tsai as well from Blue Ginger. So it should be a huge show, and I want it to grow and grow and grow. And this year I'm going to try and tie in music with the music festival and then the food and wine. And again, we'll raise money for this campaign. Yep. So.
And what do you think when you said they said it was the best show or a great show? What do you bring to that? What is making it so good?
Here's what you have to do in a show. In the past, a lot of chefs I've seen come to a show, and they do food that's easy and quick, and it's like an effortless task. My goal is, if you come to my show, it has to be the same dish you're going to serve in your restaurant. So, for example, if Eric from Head of the Wood comes in, I want to see the same dish that he has that makes him popular on the plate going out to the guests at the food and wine show. Same for me, same for the guests as well. It has to be the best showing of what we can do, not something just quick and easy. It has to be really great food. And it was great, and the price point was inexpensive, too. Last year we were $25, excuse me. This year we're $45 because I have more chefs.
Right.
It has to be affordable. It has to be something where anybody can come to. And we had 300 guests last year, and this year we're shooting for 500. And for our first event, 300 was fantastic.
Unbelievable.
So it's good.
That's great. Well, why don't we take another short break so we can hear some more music. This time maybe we'll hear something from Diane's soundtrack, and we'll be right back.
Georgia. Oh, Georgia. And the whole day through. Yes, it's just this whole sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. I said, Georgia, another. Georgia, and the song of you comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines. Mm-hmm. Other arms reach out to me. Other eyes smile tenderly.
So we were just listening to Ray Charles. You're listening to Cooks and Books on the Heritage Radio Network, where our sponsor is Fairway Market, like no other market. And my guests are Diane Imrie and Chef Mark Timms. And Ray Charles is one of the musicians that Diane likes to listen to when she cooks. And what about that inspiration from music in the kitchen and in your writing, since you wrote Cooking Close to Home? Tell us a little bit about the process of the writing.
Of the writing.
And
well,
when that took place.
It started, as I mentioned, about 3 years ago, and really we developed the recipes first. So we saved most of the writing, but there's a harvest hint in almost all the recipes, and we saved that writing until nearer the end, which I have to say might not have been the best approach. We should have started the writing a little earlier. We had ideas all along about, okay, we need to have a tip about how to freeze blueberries, or we need to have a tip about how to ask about poultry and how it's raised, but we didn't start really writing them until towards the end. But for inspiration around the writing, it certainly came from what I was seeing at farmers markets and at farms. We did a lot of touring. So when I go to Montreal, my family's in Montreal, I go to the market. I go to Atwater Market or I go to Gentilly Market and find a little inspiration there, even recipe inspiration for products that we like to make. Music inspiration, I just like to have the music on. I had a hard time when you asked me what music I like. I just like to have the music on. Uh-huh. So I can listen to a variety of different things, and I like most of it, and I'm surprised at how many songs I know all the words to. It really surprises me sometimes, even though I haven't heard The Smiths in 15 years,
maybe.
A few years, so.
So, but you had talked about you wished you had done it earlier, and yet you did self-publish this, so just part of the learning curve of a first time?
Our biggest, I think the thing we learned all along the way, in every step of the way, was we need to plan at least twice the amount of time for every step as we thought we did. The photography in particular was very time intensive. So we did the food styling for all of the photos. And so for a full day of prep and a full day on site with a photographer, we came out with 5 photos a day. And so we have about 40 of the finished dish photos in the book. So that's a lot of time.
Right.
And then just finding a printer and going through the whole bit of printing took longer than we thought. And
you're in your second printing,
yes,
which is really exciting.
We get our new books on Friday, so we've sold the first full printing is gone. So I have one piece left in the cupboard. So.
Well, and I just wanted, you're not a food stylist. So you said you did the food styling, and folks who will see the book will see the photographs are beautiful. And where did all that come from? Just looking at hundreds of cookbooks?
Or? No, actually, what our intention was to really have the food look real. So we didn't do a lot of fussing. We didn't use, there's only one photo in the book, and I won't tell you which one it is, that needed a little help. But all of the other photos don't even really have any glaze or anything on it. It's really fresh, real food, and that was our intention. So that in a way made it actually a little easier. It was okay if there was something dripping off the side of the pot.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it would look in your kitchen. And the photographer, Andy Wellman, was wonderful. We had a vision of what we wanted the plate to look like, including, you know, did we want it on wood? Did we want a fire in the background? And then he would put the photo together so that it would look exactly the way we were trying to communicate it. So he was wonderful to work with.
Which you had a wonderful experience, because so often an author writes the recipes but doesn't really get any input into
exactly
how the book will look, what the typeface will be. You were able to really control it.
Yep.
What makes a great recipe, chef? What makes a great recipe, do you think?
That's hard to ask. I mean, sometimes simple things make recipes. I mean, I think that's a really tough one to answer. For me, looking at it, it's anything that I personally enjoy eating myself, and it's not just the recipes, how it turns out, how it looks, and how the final product is.
I mean, because there are certain, like Toll House cookies, right? I mean,
yeah.
Who would have thought, right? That became this sort of, you know, but even within that, there's the puffy, there's the flat,
right,
there's the chewy.
I think recipes are a guide. You know, I would encourage folks to use the recipes in the book. The first time, maybe follow the recipe. The second time, add something of your own. There's no reason, unless baking. Baking might be a little bit different.
Uh-huh.
But if you're sauteing something, there's no reason to not add something that's a flavor that you like. I think it's just a guide.
That's true.
And that's coming from a cookbook author. So
Right. Well,
sure
I think many cookbook authors probably feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
One might judge a great cookbook by how inspiring is it.
Mm-hmm.
Does it inspire me to want to go in the kitchen and cook, even
yeah.
if I would think about maybe changing something? What are your top three cookbooks?
That's easy.
Number one,
White Heat by Marco Pierre White.
Yeah.
Number two, French Laundry.
We've thought about this question.
This is an easy question. And then Happy in the Kitchen by Michelle Richard.
I love that one.
Which you'll see the virtual egg in there as well.
Oh, really?
Get it in there. And I draw inspiration from a lot of books, and those three definitely. And you're right. I look at recipes and I say, okay, this is a good recipe. Let's change it and let's make the dish look our version of this dish.
Mm.
So
mm-hmm. Now, those are all fairly current, though.
Marco Pierre White is a pretty old, but he's in 1991.
Yeah.
And then Laundry is 97.
Yeah.
Michelle Richard, 2005, I think.
Wow.
So those are great books.
You almost have to be a chef to cook from those books, though, I think.
Yeah, you're right. You do.
I mean, I have them, and in my kitchen, they're picture books.
Right.
They're a little advanced.
Well, you know what? I can draw inspiration from this. I can take this book home.
Chef's looking at Diane's book.
And I like this book, because you're right. The photographs are fantastic. The way it's laid out is great. It's easy for me, because I want to look quick, glance, and go.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. You did a very good job.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So what are some of the inspiring books that you like? Three of your top cookbooks.
Oh, that's really hard, I have to say, because it's been a long time since I looked at cookbooks because we've been so busy cooking ourselves and trying to get our book out. But I have a cookbook on preserves that's about 15 years old, and it was beautifully done. It comes from England, actually. Can't remember the name of the author, but that was an inspiring book for me because I knew that when they put that book together, it was all about fresh farm food, and so that's really an inspiration. I rarely use the recipes, but I still like to flip through
the
book.
Uh-huh.
I like Deb Madison's Local Flavors.
Uh-huh.
That's a nice cookbook, and there's a cookbook. What is the name of it? It's from the market. No, from the garden. It's from the Cook's Garden seed catalog.
Oh, right,
of all
right.
places.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that interesting because if I'm in a pinch and I've got something that I need to do with peppers, for instance, she had a hot sauce recipe that's great.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of an interesting mix of cookbooks, but I don't have any of those that you mentioned on your list.
So it'll give you something to go look
yes.
for.
Or I can come to your house.
You can
yes.
come to my house
hundreds,
and see them, because
I
do have this collection, which is one reason why
yes.
I wanted to do this show, because
yes.
I'm so addicted to cookbooks. One thing I wanted to also ask you about is, what are some of your favorite foods? What couldn't you live without? What couldn't you have in your kitchen?
I couldn't live without Rice Krispies.
Rice Krispies.
I couldn't live without.
Gabrielle's smiling at that
she
one.
She knows that's true. I couldn't live without chocolate parfait and the chocolate mousses that you get. Mm-hmm. I like those too. I cook well, but sometimes when I go home, I don't eat as well as I should. And another thing I couldn't live without, fish and chips.
Coffee? Mm. What about coffee? I was going to say coffee.
I've actually come off coffee in the last week.
Come off
I've switched
last
to tea.
Week
it's taken
you.
Me 20 years to come off coffee.
Now that's something we should have talked about. And was that just too jazzed in the kitchen?
Too much caffeine. I'm getting older. Yeah. I'm feeling the effects of coffee.
Yeah. Wow. Do you think it affects your palate? Coffee, because it's so bitter. Do you think if you're tasting as a chef cooking for people and you're sipping coffee every other minute, you're affecting your palate?
I think it could. It's possible. I haven't noticed that, but I'm sure it could.
Yeah. And what about you, Diane?
Oh,
three things you couldn't live without.
Could not live without bread.
Okay.
Bread. Olive oil.
Ben and Jerry's.
Ben and Jerry's.
Cherry Garcia. Yeah. Okay, a little plug for Ben and Jerry there.
I almost always have a good variety of cheese in the fridge, just because I can't live without it.
Okay.
What else? Olive. I'm definitely Italian in another life.
Okay. A lot of the
coffee.
Salty kind of.
Yep. Anything salty. Now, if you ask me what I shouldn't be eating and I can't pass up if it's in front of me, chips.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so
definitely chips.
Gabrielle's on
weakness.
That one, too.
Yours is Ben and Jerry's, mine's chips.
Yeah, so we have the salty and the sweet, which is interesting from a taste perspective, how people tend to fall into that.
Right.
I would think.
I have a sweet tooth.
Yeah.
And when
yeah,
you're...
I can pass on the chocolate.
And this is sort of a different kind of question, but I was at a cooking class yesterday, and this came up. The new salts, since we're talking about salty and sweet... What do you think about this? Himalayan pink salt, and do they really make a big difference?
We use a lot of kosher salt, a lot of sea salt, and I think, yes, you do. I think, number one, I like to remove all salt and pepper shakers from the tables to begin with, and as the food come out, if you want to season it then use some of these nice salts. I have used the pink salt.
Mm-hmm.
A little grainy, but I think they had a nice touch to a dish. I think you need less.
Now, they often say one of the things home cooks don't do well is season their food. So they're afraid to use enough salt, or they don't know how to get the balance of salt and acid. What would you say if you could give a home cook one great tip about how to bring their food to the next level? Is that a fair question?
No, because honestly, when my wife cooks for me, I love it than I eat. I appreciate somebody else cooking for me. And the flavor is... You're right, actually. Sometimes, I'm sure not listening to this, but sometimes I don't tell mommy this, but it needs a little bit of salt. It does. You're right.
And sometimes it's all about your taste buds, too, because
right.
I know Richard, my co-author, when he started at the hospital as the executive chef, his palate was much more accustomed to salty.
Right.
And because for some diets we have such strict guidelines when you're in the hospital for heart disease, you know, your sodium intake has to be so much lower. And he tells us that his palate and his wife's palate has become accustomed to less salt because he cooks a little bit more that way at home now. So I think your palate can change, too.
Well, and I would think with the spa cuisine that you're doing at the Top Notch Resort, you have to be conscious of that, right, of how much sodium.
You absolutely do, yes. You do. And you're actually right. When I was at the Ledger Woodlock and I was eating spa food for 6 months, I grew accustomed to different flavors, and my cravings went away for the fats and the salts. And
so that's good news for our listeners. You can teach yourself to crave those things
less. Yeah, that's true. So
we'll take one more break, and then we're going to come back. I want to share more about Team Vermont and what's going to go on at the James Beard House in March. And just take a minute, and let's see who we're going to hear now.
Looks like morning in your eyes, but the clock's held 9:15 for hours. Sunrise, sunrise, couldn't tempt us if it tried, 'cause the afternoon's already come and gone. And I said, who? Ooh. couldn't find it in your eyes, but I'm sure it's written all over my face. Surprise, surprise, never something I could hide. When I see we made it through another day, then I say,
welcome back to Cooks and Books on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro, and our sponsor is the Fairway Market, like no other market. And I'm here with my guest, Mark Timms, Chef Mark Timms from the Top Notch Resort and Spa, and with Diane Imrie, author of Cooking Close to Home. And we just have a couple of minutes left in the show, and before we close, I want to ask Chef Timms to tell us a little bit about this dinner coming up at the James Beard House. And I'm sure many of you know that the James Beard House is a wonderful nonprofit in the city of New York.
That's right.
And Chef was there last year, and you did a dinner that impressed everybody so much, they invited you back, and you said, I'm going to bring a few friends.
That's right. It was a great honor to cook there last year. I think it was May 12th. Oh, was it May 19th? I forget. Anyway, it was May of last year, and I was invited back, and I thought, well, instead of doing the James Beard by myself, invite what I consider some of the top local talent in Vermont. And so I put together a team of Vermont chefs, six total chefs, to go down there, each to do a course and an hors d'oeuvres, and really showcase what Vermont is good at, and put Vermont on the radar for James Beard and some spotlight for some of these chefs. And we will be there March 22nd, and hopefully we sell out, and I know it'll be a success, and I'm really excited. It's a great time for us chefs to get together, egos to one side, and get along and build this foundation of what could be down the road of more James Beards and more wine dinners.
And when you're bringing together, because these are all chefs who are very talented in
right.
their own right, how do you coordinate a menu when you've got, you know, you've got seven leaders as opposed to followers?
It was funny because most of them took a back seat to my ideas of how it'll be organized, and then I listened to their input for the menu, and the menu seemed to flow right off the bat. There was no real debating as don't do this, don't do that. The reason why we did the preview dinner was to look at our dishes and see what works, what doesn't work. And the only thing we could come up with is that we need smaller portions. And but it was quite easy. Some of these guys are really fun to work with, and there is no ego. They all want the same thing. They want Vermont to do well and showcase the state in New York City. And it just flows. You know it's going to be successful when things just flow right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And it did, so.
And the hope is that we'll draw attention to Vermont, and then that will get people to want to come and
right.
dine and be here.
Dine, be here. I want to see some of these chefs win the James Beard. I want to see more
what
stories.
What does that do for a chef, winning the James
it's
Beard?
It's like winning an Emmy. It really
mm-hmm.
is. It's fantastic. And Al's won it. They won the American Classic. God bless them. That's fantastic.
And chef's referring to somewhere called Al's French Fry.
Right.
They've been in Vermont for, I don't know, how many years?
Decades, yeah.
Decades and decades, and they're known for their French fries and their burgers, and they won a James Beard Award.
Yeah,
so
the American Classic, and I would love to see one of these guys. I'm not eligible this year to win because I haven't been in this area for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But to see if I saw Eric win it or Stephen Laura, brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm all for that, so good.
Well, and I'm sure you will win it when you've been here longer as well, when you have that chance. So hopefully if folks are interested, you can go to the James Beard website. And unfortunately, I don't have the details of that site, but just put in James Beard in any search engine,
right.
and you'll be able to find the dinner on March 22nd. All of you listening in New York, if you want to join us, that would be great. So we're just about out of time for our show. I want to thank my guests, Diane Imrie and Chef Mark Timms. And please join us on March 8th when I'll have another great Cook and Book to share with you. Thanks so much.